It is Saturday, July 12th, 2014. We are broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio 88.9 and KUSP.org. And ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for Geek Speak. Well, welcome. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or any of the geeks affiliated organizations. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch in the host chair today, and with me in the studio is Lindsay Lonnie, systems analyst and web programmer.
Good morning.
And Lyle Troxell, photographer, programmer, and newlywed.
Hey, that's me.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Do you feel different?
I don't. But
why'd you do it?
Because it's fun to celebrate. It's fun to bring community together and acknowledge a union. So yeah, it was nice.
Well, congratulations.
And thanks for being there.
Thanks. Lots to talk about today. And a lot of it has to do with phones.
It does, doesn't it?
It's sort of a phone-based edition of Geek Speak. Of course, we'll be talking about other stuff also. Ironically, we won't be taking calls today. But let's just tuck into it, shall we? There was some hullabaloo from NPR, actually, about having an FM radio in all mobile phones in case of emergency. I kind of thought there was an FM radio in all mobile phones.
Well, there is an FM radio in all mobile phones, actually. Well, 60% of phones or so have an FM chip.
Smartphones.
But it doesn't mean that they're active. There's a lot of technology in a phone that's not actually available to you. And that's because it's a commercial product and they make a lot of stuff baked into the hardware. And then we don't, the product is designed to be flexible and then it's implemented in a certain way. So you could kind of say that the carriers don't necessarily want an FM radio on your phone and that's why they haven't turned it on. Some phones are actually designed such that when they do the hardware, they get a chipset that do a whole bunch of things. Mm-hmm. One of them is a universal antenna, if you will, or universal receiving system, which happens to be able to also support FM, but it's also doing the Wi-Fi, right? So it's a programmatical radio inside the phone that does, there's lots of radios, right? There's cell radio, there's FM radio, there's different types of FM, or different types of cell radio. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there's the Bluetooth antenna. All these things are actually radios. Mm-hmm. And so it's possible that the phone itself is not designed to promote the what we think of as FM broadcast or AM broadcast radios. But technically, it has kind of the hardware inside it. Does that make enough sense?
It does. And I'm a little outside of this one because I do have an FM radio in my phone and I've listened to it.
Do you have a Microsoft phone?
Yes, I do.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Well, and one of the weird things...
Well, Apple doesn't do it, so I knew it was something else.
Yeah. And neither does Verizon. Is ahead of the game on this one, apparently.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But why wouldn't a mobile phone want to just turn on the FM chip if it's in there already?
That's a great question. In Europe and Asia, the FM radios by default are enabled and turned on. It's only, well, I shouldn't say only, but almost only in the United States that they're by default not enabled. And usually it's the same hardware that you're using in different countries.
And it's about scale, right? If they're going to make a phone, they might as well make a phone that works in both countries. And so physically it's
so
it has
an
FM phone.
They make it for the Europeans. Yeah. So then phone companies here just go, no, I don't want to turn it on.
Yeah, some people say it's because if people are using their FM radios, they're not going to use streaming media services as much.
And which they're not the cell phone company gets, of course. Anything you've sent over the data line, theoretically, the cell phone company can charge you.
Right. So,
surely in Europe where those FM radios are turned on in phones, they've been able to do a study. Do people use online services less if they're listening to the radio on their phone?
I'm assuming so. I haven't seen those studies, but I've seen percentages of data differences with people that use their phones for, listening to FM radio.
So I got a question, Bonnie. You've got an FM radio in your phone.
Sure.
You clearly like radio because, hey, you work at a radio station.
I'm
and have been here
of a
for
radio
years.
Geek. I might be more of a radio geek than the average bear.
I totally agree.
Yeah.
Do you listen to the FM radio on your phone?
Not very often.
Ah, why is that?
Well, because...
I assumed as much, by the way, but because most people don't.
I'm generally not plugged into my phone anyway. Mm-hmm. I'm a gross underutilizer of the smartphone in general.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So there's a lot of stuff that is
available
on my phone.
That's why you have a Microsoft phone.
Yeah. I'm like, might as well have
you don't
this
care
thing.
Very much.
Or vice versa, but we don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
Exactly. So I'm not fiddling with the audio on my phone that much anyway.
Right. And of course, you know, the phone, when you use it as a listening device, is a personal listening device. Your car can share somebody else. If you're in it, it's got an FM radio. I'm assuming that's where you listen.
Yeah, that's mostly
and at
where
home,
I listen to radio.
You can do it, right? You
exactly.
have your tuner at home, and it's always set to 88.9 in mm-hmm. Santa Cruz.
Yeah.
And you're always getting a good feed of KUSP.
Exactly.
So those places make sense. The phone itself, you have to kind of commit to putting in earbuds and actually making it part of your listening habits.
Right.
So one of the arguments, one of the strongest arguments to have the FM on, the reason what, you know, the kind of underlying story is from a safety perspective, we all know that when a disaster happens, cell phone systems come really unreliable, and all of a sudden you can't call people. Mm-hmm. You definitely can't do data at that point when the cell phone systems are too clogged. Mm-hmm. And so all of a sudden, what is your tether point, especially when you rely on it so much, this phone? So
that's a good point. Because, yeah. you know, we've been in power outages where I had a cell phone tower right across the street. That was also a victim of the power outage,
right.
and then we didn't have cell phone service. Thank goodness I had my landline. That's a whole other topic.
That is. So from a safety perspective...
So would the FM chip work even if the cell towers are
yes.
out?
Yeah.
The
FM chip is really just an FM radio inside your phone. I mean, it would be equivalent to getting an FM radio and taping it to your phone, right? Except mm-hmm. it happens to use the battery of the phone. It happens to use the audio of the phone.
Yeah.
And, of course, you have to have software on your phone to tune the radio. That's the other thing. Is you have to have an app to say, hey, I want to go to 889 or some other station.
Right.
So from my perspective, it makes a lot of sense to have that FM radio enabled from a safety perspective.
Mm-hmm.
That argument, and that's why that's the lead argument, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because, of course we should do that. In a safety situation, we should have as much communication as possible.
Right.
But I can totally see the other side that we have a giant commercial infrastructure in this country about broadcast powers. And the thing that the internet theoretically does, especially if we agree with... making it free and open, is it makes every voice as strong. So just because you have a national network of radio stations that covers a whole bunch of content, it doesn't mean you have a louder voice on the internet, right?
Mm-hmm.
And on FM,
mm-hmm.
even though we work at a community station and this is public radio and it's very different beast than the commercial, the interest in this party strongly are the commercial radio stations, right? They want to have more listenership in their area. And if you give everybody an FM station, an FM phone, an FM radio, it's likely they'll have more listeners.
Okay. So there's different motivations then for NPR teaming up with commercial broadcasting to
right.
ask that FM radio turned on in your smartphone should be legal.
Right.
Like it should legally required.
Right. So this is the argument, is that it should be legally required from a safety perspective, and it's already there. So this movement is to say legally mandate those chips to be turned on.
Mm-hmm.
And the side effect, of course, would be that everybody would have an FM radio with them, which would be kind of cool. Or 60% of smartphone carriers would be that. And as us people that have been doing radio here, we love that idea. Now, let's talk about the magic of FM radio versus other forms of media or AM radio. Location-based broadcast mm-hmm. has a real power that a lot of other medium doesn't have, right? It's really cool to be able to turn on a radio and know that the area you're currently in is being serviced by these people. That's where they are. And, you know, we service the central coast of California. If you hear KUSP from radio,
sense of place.
You know that we're in the same location as you. And we're going to talk about the events downtown. We're going to kind of, it's about community.
Central coastiness.
Yeah. That's the theory, at least.
Yeah. That's the theory. But so why shouldn't it? Why shouldn't it be required by law? Is it a big hassle to turn on the FM chip?
It's one of those things that's kind of interesting. A minority is trying to force it to be a law so that everybody gets it. I think the majority of the population doesn't really care. And so should it be forced and mandated? I think that it would be better to say, here's a protocol that all the phones have to respond to that will turn on the radio and tune it to a certain channel and you can listen to it, right? So like kind of an Amber Alert kind of concept where in an emergency situation you could turn on all phones and they would start having the receiving. That would be a perfect, you know, it's only for safety, let's mandate this, which kind of makes sense, right? You make sure you can send data out. You know, what if we had some disaster where you wanted to warn
people?
You're
talking about why it should be legal.
Yeah, I'm saying that if you made that the specific law, you said, we're not only going to say the FM chip has to be turned on, but actually we have to have this new protocol where if the phone gets communicated with in this way, there's a digital line that actually goes along with radio broadcasts. It's called RBDS, Radio Broadcast Digital System. And it's the old pagers used to run off of this. They still do, actually. Mm-hmm. And it's basically our carrier has a subcarrier that has some digital information and it can send out information. So you could assume that a phone could kind of listen to that regularly and then broadcast information about it if it was available. And it, you wouldn't have to know where people were because you're broadcasting from a certain location. So if they can hear that signal, they're in the area and should be notified. So there's some power to that location-based warning in an emergency situation. Okay. So if the law was you have to implement this new standard, which allows for better emergency communication, then it's like a no-brainer. Let's do that because assuming the cost is not too high, it's a good social good. But if you say instead you have to turn on the radio chip, and all that really does is allows people to listen to the radio, and maybe people will listen to the radio in an emergency.
Hasn't really been made.
It doesn't really help the emergency situation. It's not a strong argument to the emergency situation.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So I guess it really depends then on who, I assume, as you've outlined, that NPR and commercial stations have different reasons.
Yes.
For well, wanting it to be turned on.
I think
they both are interested in getting more listeners.
I think the whole argument of the reason why the radio station companies and such are interested in turning this on is because they're in a digital age where their listenership is failing and dying, and it's really bad for radio right now.
Yeah.
I think that's an underlying current.
Scattered attention.
They tried this in 2010 and in 2012 to get this passed into law, and back then it was more about you want to have FM radio, don't you? And now it's like it's a safety issue. And, you know, I can see the safety issue side. That's a powerful argument.
It is a powerful argument.
But, yeah,
I agree.
It sounds
like it might not be the real motivation.
Right. And I don't think a law will be able to be passed by a minority with that argument because of things like what Lyle said. You know, there's better ways to do that if it's a safety thing.
Right.
So then how do you incentivize cell phone companies to want to just go ahead and turn on the on button?
I mean, the only way that's going to happen is if consumers demand it. And so, you know, we can raise awareness, and then people, when they go to buy their next cell phone, can say, I want the one cell phone that you're selling that has the FM radio enabled in it. And then over time, you know, the carriers will start selling more cell phones like that. But I don't know if that, you know, if enough people are going to demand something like that.
I still don't understand.
What?
Why, if they put the chip in there, they don't bother to turn it on. I don't understand
it. So first off, if you do power up that antenna of that FM, you're going to drain more power.
Mm-hmm.
The system's going to lose more battery power, and they're conservative on battery power.
There's one reason. They're going to have to provide tech support for that piece of hardware that's in there. And, you know,
okay,
it's more
so it's not just pushing a button and walk away.
And when you ask a consumer, what are the 50 things your phone wants to do? FM radio is pretty low on the list.
Yeah.
And so they're not going to sell more radios because it's on.
Yeah,
I mean, did you buy your? Is the reason why you have a Microsoft phone is because it have an FM radio? Was that a selling point for you?
No, I like the color.
Yeah, I think it's more likely actually that people would say yes, I do want an FM radio on my phone.
Yeah,
and then would actually never use it because I think that's a really important way of thinking about how you provide a product to a customer, especially in this day and age, where even though they think they want everything, the truth is if you simplify it and streamline it, they're more likely to use the features they really use.
Right.
So, that's like a strong argument about the Android versus iPhone kind of debate, is that Apple really locks things down. It's kind of a controlled environment. And if you really want flexibility, go over to Android. But with that flexibility means more complexity. And so depending on how you want, and Android, of course, I don't want to say it's really complex. It's getting better and better, especially when it's wrapped up with a service provider that limits it as well.
Uh-huh.
But I think just having more and more and more is not necessarily great. I would love my phone to be able to use all the frequencies of my radio because then I could listen in on other things. Like the radio that's in our phone right now, and when I say radio, I mean the antenna pickup system. They're amazing devices.
Mm-hmm.
And you could theoretically tune to air traffic control data and listen to it on your phone. Like your phone can pick up a lot of frequencies it doesn't.
Yeah.
You could theoretically tune to the to FM and Wi-Fi and outside of Wi-Fi and listen to other things. You could with your phone, if the software allowed it, you could detect when a microwave was turned on near you. Right. This is the kind of things you can do when you have an all-purpose radio, software-controlled radio, which we all have them. But they're locked down, and they're locked down for kind of a good reason. The cell company doesn't really want you playing in that space. They want you to conserve power so that you're using their service more, and you think of their phone as good and their service is good. And they want you to use their radio, the cell phone.
Yeah.
The cell phone radio. So I personally don't. What do you guys think? Do you think it should be a law? I mean,
I think, where do you draw the line then with safety laws? You know, I have a wind up, you know, two-way NOAA radio in my car. And, you know, that's one of my emergency preparedness things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then you could say,
a lot of us who gave to public radio already have gotten our emergency radio.
Yes.
That's what you do.
Exactly,
you give to public radio, you get an emergency radio, and then you don't need
Okay, that's a good point.
And that's the thing. It's like, you know, I think it's kind of up to the individual how much you want to be prepared for things. The government can't mandate that I need 3 days worth of water in my car. You know, like where okay. do you draw the line?
That would be a waste of gas, yeah, yeah. too.
So if right. you frame it like there's a problem that people need information in an emergency, like yeah. that's a problem that needs to be solved. And this proposed mandate that an FM radio be turned on in your cell phone is one specific idea for how to solve that problem.
Or, right. you know, the where do you say that maybe, you know, the government safety organization has to tell people how to enable the radio in their phones as part of the here's your safety information.
Of course, we can't do that on,
if
in
you
a
have
lot
an AT&T, I can do it on my phone because it's an Android phone.
Yeah.
All Android phones, but you have to root your phone first and you void the warranty.
Yes.
So they know that as well, you know, that if you really want to use it, if you're one of that small percentage of people who want to use your FM radio,
so
you're probably
you
one of those people who can root your phone.
Yeah.
And
there's
you know,
specifically an advantage for them not to require this thing so that if you are savvy enough to root your phone, they benefit from you not being in your warranty anymore. And then if something goes wrong, they get more money from you.
And they don't have to cover the tech support of you doing it because it was outside of the scope of what they want
right.
to support.
Yeah,
right.
yeah. And Miles is pointing out that you know they also have to write the driver for mm-hmm. the FM radio. They have to write the apps that use that driver. There's all the development and QA and all the stuff
and
associated
yeah.
with that. All right. Well, there's lots more to talk about here on Geek Speak, and we're going to do it in just a minute. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch in the host chair, and with me in the air room is Lyle Troxell and Lindsay Lani. And this is one of many great shows on KUSP. Another good one is the 7th Avenue Project that airs Sundays at high noon on KUSP. And next time on the 7th Avenue Project, it's poetry, prison, and two lives. Judith Tenenbaum was a teacher working in San Quentin. Spoon Jackson was an inmate serving a life sentence. On this archive edition of the show, they talk about how they met, discovered a mutual love of poetry, and their 20-year friendship across prison walls. That's the 7th Avenue Project, tomorrow at high noon on KUSP, or whenever you look for it, in the talk section at kusp.org. Well, this is the part of the show where we talk about things that look really good. It's the geek bit on Geek Speak. And Lindsay, you've got one for us this week.
I sure do. So on my Google notifications, I'm subscribed to the NASA because I love all that space stuff. And they announced a thing called Beautiful Earth, where you can go and download wallpapers for your computer that are, you know, satellite and other images of Earth that have been kind of enhanced, some of them colorized, and they are gorgeous. Mm-hmm. One of my favorites is the night lights, where it's sort of like a global map, and it's all at night, and then you can just see, like, the light pollution from the major cities.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, right here.
But, and so how does that work? Can you just, like, choose which one you want to use as a wallpaper, or does it automatically upload a new one for you every once in a while?
Nope, you just pick the one you want, you download it, and you can put it, or you can download a bunch of them and put them in your wallpaper folder and use an app to cycle through them, different things like
that. Okay,
there's,
nice.
Like, two different sizes of each one, depending on what resolution you want, how big your monitor is, let's say.
Juicy. Okay, so we're going to link to that at geekspeak.org really any moment now. And when that happens, you'll be able to see for yourself the gorgeousness that comes direct from NASA to you.
But NASA's not the only space organization in the United States now.
Some of the private guys are making more headway in some cases.
It is. You know Elon Musk, right, Bonnie?
Not personally.
Swoon.
But he is sort of a favorite dreamboat of the show.
Yeah,
geeky dreamboat.
Well, he just kind of produces these great stories to talk about, you know, like life-changing stories, like
all the
Tesla
time.
Car or the crazy transportation system. From
the high rail.
Yes.
Yeah, high-speed rail.
Mm-hmm.
And what's he working on now? Spaceport.
Yeah, well, so, you know, SpaceX is the organization that he founded. It's actually the Space Exploration Technologies Corp. And it was founded in 2002 by Elon Musk and a lot of other people involved, of course.
Yeah.
And they've been, you know, launching things into space privately, which is kind of amazing. And one of the trouble that SpaceX has had is trying to get a place where they can legally launch rockets and other things into space, because we have Cape Canaveral, United States,
right.
But that's NASA system, space.
Those guys weren't getting along, right? Like,
well,
you wanted to use the spaceport and like, no.
Well, it's kind of like, you know, if you have an outside company coming in and they're using this you know, spaceport of then NASA's not able to use it, right? So in some ways it makes sense to have these commercial enterprises actually have their own space to do these kind of launches.
It would be like every airline having their own airport, though.
You would think that, but I get that point. Definitely, it's kind of a concern.
I mean, ideally, we're headed there, right? We have that much competition.
It's possible that that would happen. I think that it makes sense to have this private funding actually make a space available that's dedicated to maybe other private, maybe other companies would come in and use that same space. But it's not a governmentally owned space.
So that would kind of fit with Elon's model of making all of his patents available to everyone,
right,
and then hoping to be a licensor of stuff for everyone to use.
So on Wednesday, the Federal Aviation Administration approved the building of a spaceport. It's 56 acres off the Gulf of Mexico in Texas, and they're basically saying, yes, you can build there a whole spaceport, which is like an airport, but for space, like Mos Eisley.
Yeah.
And hopefully it won't be full of scum and villainy.
Yeah.
And you can go ahead and do that, and you can go ahead and launch 10 Falcon 9 rockets and 2 Falcon Heavy rockets per year. So that's a lot of rocket launches per year.
Yeah.
Through 2025. So basically, okay, it's kind of a trial thing of some degree. But,
yeah. And this, who had to say yes to that?
The FAA.
The FAA had to. Okay.
The Federal Aviation Administration had to approve it. And so they approved it. And that's the first commercial space port. And they're saying also with that, it's not just the location. It's also that, yes, you're approved to launch this many rockets into space. And therefore, SpaceX is kind of approved to be a real agency that's doing that.
Yeah, yeah.
Private, but
that's
pretty amazing.
That's kind of fun.
Yeah.
And so is that the only approval they needed? Or, I mean, do they have to now go talk to the local area governments and say, hey, can we build a big thing
here? That was it. That was the last step.
Because it was on federal property?
No, because they own the property. They got the property. That's not the problem.
The
property. Yeah.
Okay.
The issue was whether it was legal to launch experimental spacecraft from that location.
Right.
And, of course, experimental spacecraft at this point in age is a redundant, right? All spacecraft are experimental.
Right.
Maybe
but, I can launch my spacecraft there. Oh, wait, no.
What's exciting is because I remember the last space shuttle launched. I didn't get to go see it. I never saw a space shuttle launch. And
no.
I was like, I never will, you know?
Yeah,
and I kinda, were you sad? You guys sad about that?
I was sad.
I saw it flying overhead on the way home to the museum.
When it buzzed us here?
Yeah.
That was pretty cool.
Yeah, that was sweet.
But now
there's a new... Rocket launches are loud.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think those little ridges in the land surrounding the airport are going to be enough to mitigate the sound and surrounding
neighborhoods. Is that what those are for?
That's what that's for.
Oh, God, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
No, it's going to be loud. But they have a lot of area, and there's a whole map. And, of course, the next stages will be local permits and such of building. But I think that any local government would be pretty cool with having their, you know, spacecraft taking off near
Point
them.
Pride, right?
And a tourism attempt. I mean, when launches happen, a lot of people come to town.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So Elon Musk and his organization is still being awesome.
Well, and he keeps doing awesome things. You know what? I was not aware of the connection between a webcomic and the Tesla Museum.
Yes.
Oh.
So I'm a little behind on this next story. Can you tell us about the oatmeal, Lindsay?
I sure can. So I don't know if you've seen the oatmeal comic. It's hilarious. If you haven't, I'd recommend it.
I've seen it now and then.
And
it shows up on my Facebook stream.
Yay. Back in 2012, the cartoonist Matt Inman, who does the oatmeal comic, he started a crowdfunding campaign to purchase real estate that contains inventor Nikola Tesla's lab, one of his old labs, to be used as a Tesla museum. They raised $1.37 million, which is, they thought would be enough to buy the real estate, which they got at $850,000, and then put some money into repairing it.
Mm-hmm.
But they found out that the disrepair was much more extensive and that building a new museum was also much more expensive than they thought. So Mr. Inman created a comic called What It's Like to Own a Tesla Model S, and he reviewed his car, which is, Tesla
Model
Tesla S.
Tesla car, okay.
And on the back of the comic...
Was it a good review?
It was a raving review. He loves his car.
He loves his Tesla.
Yeah. He added a brazen plea to Elon Musk. Should I read it in quotes?
Yeah,
it's pretty
funny.
Quote unquote, "You owe us nothing, and you've done nothing but good things in the name of Nikola Tesla. But the fact remains, Tesla Motors, a company now worth billions, is using Nikola Tesla's name and they're using his technology, and all we want in return is a little bit of help. During our initial Tesla Museum fundraiser, you supported the project and donated $2,500. I'm asking you to donate again, but this time donate the full $8 million."
That was in the comic? Like the end of the comic?
It was the back, yeah. Like the backside of the comic.
Is $8 million what's going to cost to get it up and running?
Yeah, that's what they're thinking. It's going to be about $8 million to, they put the money in a nonprofit, and the nonprofit has a board,
mm-hmm.
and they got a bunch of consultants and put together what they wanted the museum to be. And if they want to get the museum that way, it's going to cost about $8 million.
Yeah.
So
okay, yeah. So the dream
and what was
is
the response?
Million.
Well, the cartoon also contained a scan of a letter from William H. Turbo, the last surviving relative of Nikola Tesla, who's in Germany. And the letter was polite, but it also made reference to the fact that Tesla Motors is using the Tesla name without, you know, any permission or, you know, kickback to the Tesla family.
Yeah.
And that it causes some confusion for him. He was called by a TV or contacted by a German TV program, and they were excited because he was a relative of the famous car maker.
Oh, no.
Confusing.
That's not right.
Wow. That's also bad journalism.
Yeah.
Right. And so
let's point that out.
Okay.
And so he recommended, you know, that Elon Musk, you know, donate some money for this program for the museum in the United States.
Yeah.
And then Matt Inman tweeted to on Elon Musk's Twitter, "I wrote a review of my Model S and asked you for a little favor here. Link," any link to the comic.
Yeah. Little favor.
Little favor. $8 million, please.
Right. And then Elon responded quickly and said, "I would be happy to help," with no specifics.
Okay.
And it turned out later he donated $1 million.
That's pretty good.
Yeah,
that's
which is great.
More than 2,500.
Yeah, they volunteered to build a Tesla supercharger station in the parking lot.
Oh,
and that usually costs Tesla a pretty penny, like $150,000 to $250,000. So, yay, thanks, Elon Musk.
Okay,
that
cool.
was really
so
cool
he,
of you.
He basically helped fund the museum and continue to make the connection between the two things confusing.
But as you said, though, it's confusing, you know, from a name perspective.
Yeah.
Bad journalism. I mean, they both have Wikipedia entries. You could read about Tesla,
yeah,
Nikola
basic.
Tesla, and know pretty quickly. It has pretty nothing to do with
basic.
It. Yeah.
They're, you know, they're reaching. They're,
yeah.
You know, but
yeah.
I think it's cool that he stepped up
also,
and helped. Yeah.
In that comic, in the back of the comic, we keep putting quotes of back because
right.
the comic, actually, you can flip it around to see the back because like it was paper, but it's not.
Right.
Yeah.
And in that, there's a reference to... and I've lost track of it.
In the comic.
In the comic, he says, "You're using his name and using his technology." Nah, I wouldn't say that Tesla actually uses his technology unless you think of Tesla, Nikola Tesla, as being interested in electricity. And if you do anything with electricity, you're using his technology.
Right, right.
I mean, sure, he's kind of a founder researcher in high voltage and other aspects of electronics or electricity flow. But that's kind of a stretch.
That's a plea reach.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And the fact that they're using the Tesla name has actually brought Tesla more popularity
sure.
and, you know, has a boon to the name.
Yeah.
So, but yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
Back at it again. We're still at it. He is our Tony Stark.
Yeah.
Okay. So at the beginning of the show, I mentioned there's a lot of stuff going on in phone foo. And so let's get to some of that other phone content. We talked about the should FM be included in every smartphone? Big debate there. You can write us at geeks@geekspeak.org if you want to weigh in on that debate. But there's lots of things happening with AT&T and Verizon. So let's start talking about that, Lindsay.
Sure thing. So the Syntonic-sponsored content store, have you heard anything about that?
Well, first of all, Syntonic is a company. I know that.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And they're, what do you mean, a sponsored content store? That's just like a place where you can go
right.
things
so
to listen to and watch?
It's so far strictly an AT&T thing.
Mm-hmm.
They have a sponsored content store, which basically means that content providers, like for your mobile device, you know, that would be, you know, like Pandora provides music content, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
They can go to be available in this content store to you, me, any consumer, and they pay the data charges so that you don't have to pay data to use their content.
Oh, I see.
And then it's more incentive for you to, you know, subscribe to their service or whatever.
All right. So Syntonic has said, look, we'll sport you for these things. And they have a list of those things.
Right.
And if those things are things that you want to use, then if you go through Syntonic, then you don't pay the data charges on this.
Right. Syntonic is a new thing. You know, the sponsored data program from AT&T is not necessarily new, but the sponsored content store is not actually an app or an app store. It's like a portal. That was created by this company, Syntonic. And if you go and utilize that, you can subscribe if you have AT&T. And then you use this portal to access major services like Amazon, Airbnb, you know, other content providers. And then you don't have to pay data while you're using those services.
That's cool. So is Syntonic some sort of subsidiary of AT&T?
I believe that they just created the technology and now they're like a partner.
Huh. So are you paying Syntonic for this?
No.
Okay.
So
the Amazon is going to pay Syntonic to pull people through.
Yeah.
So could you watch Amazon Instant Movies through Syntonic through your data plan and they would pay for that?
It
seems like
seems a little iffy. I think you can watch trailers.
Right.
Yeah.
But I doubt that you can watch movies.
Yeah. I mean, I think the movies are always an app, and the app wouldn't be able to do this kind of thing. It's only like through a web portal. I assume this is how this would work.
Yeah. It's not apps. You're just using a link to visit the site.
Yeah.
So Amazon.com or
Smile. I'm confused about that. I hear that a lot, that, you know, if you go, you'll go to our website and then click on the Amazon link from there, and then we get a little bit portions of all your Amazon shopping.
Right, yeah.
It's like, how does it make sense for Amazon? Because you're going to buy the stuff anyway, you go there directly, or they can give some money to some middle person.
Yeah.
I guess it's just about getting their name out there.
Or
I think it's more about getting as many links to Amazon as possible across the net.
You know? Yeah.
Worth it to them.
Well, it's like, why do restaurants do those fundraisers where, like, a portion of today's proceeds go to organization X or Y?
Yeah.
It gets more people in the door, right?
It's like free advertising. You know, somebody wouldn't go to Amazon unless they heard it from their favorite.
This is similar to, you know, remember early cheap PCs? You could get a personal computer that would actually have ads on it, and the computer and the service was free. And this seems very similar to that idea, that at some point, maybe your entire phone experience could be subsidized by these companies that want to watch and monetize your activity. I kind of assume the cell carrier is already doing that, but maybe, you know, they're still getting money from us. So maybe a middle company needs to come into play like this to allow that.
Yeah.
Wow. All right. So that's interesting. And let's see. AT&T and Verizon have both been implicated, or accused anyway, of using fees to charge everyone more than they should. Is this a follow-up on what we talked about last week, Lindsay?
Yeah, a little bit. You know, there's a lot of people that are kind of calling the extortion, you know, monopoly and extortion on these granular fees that are happening for access. And stuff like this, they're saying, well, now these vendors are going to have priority access, you know, and other small companies are not going to be able to drive traffic to them.
Sounds like net neutrality issues.
Exactly what a lot of people are saying it's related to is, you know, open internet laws and net neutrality, that these are issues. And there's another thing I was going to talk about that's kind of related to that. With AT&T and Verizon, they're being accused of using data roaming fees to overcharge everybody.
Yeah.
So there's a filing with the Federal Communications Commission that four public interest groups are claiming AT&T and Verizon are extracting quote-unquote monopoly rents from competitors who pay them for data roaming. And then that forces the smaller carriers to charge higher prices to their own subscribers, which in turn allows Verizon and AT&T to keep their prices higher because they don't have anyone competing with them with lower prices.
Hmm. Okay, and so, data roaming is if you're in an environment and your cell carrier doesn't actually have an antenna there, you could use AT&T's antenna. And when you do that, AT&T then charges your cell phone carrier a fee, and normally that fee is kind of passed on to consumers, but maybe not the full amount. And anyway, that produces this kind of monopoly expense rate for data roaming, or for data in general. Interesting.
Yeah. So T-Mobile had a request for a ruling from the FCC trying to force them to negotiate lower rates, and they're basically saying everything's fine the way it is. You know, and so the article, I'll post it on geekspeak.org, but it has a lot of detail about the history of what they've been charging every year, you know, how it's decreased and increased, what areas are roaming and what are not, you know, kind of crunching the numbers. So if anyone's interested in that, like I was, the article will be there.
Okay. Well, there's even more phone stuff to talk about after a little short break. You're listening to Geekspeak here on KUSP. I'm Bonnie Primsch in the host chair with Lindsay Lonnie and Lyle Troxell. And I misspoke a little bit before the break. We don't have much to say about phones themselves, but about companies that provide services over our, and I'm putting this in little hand quotes, air quotes now, phones. More and more our phones are less about the phone.
Yeah.
Right? And it's more about watching movies on a teeny tiny screen or, you know, using your FM radio. That kind of
thing. It's funny, we're like putting this on your phones. It's like FM radios and data roaming.
I rarely get a phone call anymore.
And now phone companies are doing data. And it's like,
I do have a home phone. And
you do?
I pay no attention to it. If someone's calling, it's either...
you pick it up.
It's either a solicitor or it's my mom. And mom will leave a message. So I just never pick up.
So why do you pay for it? I mean, besides loving
emergencies.
Your mother.
I don't trust the power to be up and running and to be able to use my cell phone when the emergency hits and the power goes out.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It's like insurance.
Well, so the phone line that goes to your house, and actually the phone lines that go to many people's houses, less and less are being used because though the phone line can handle DSL, DSL is not nearly as fast as the other technologies that are coming into play. Cable is one of the big ones. Yeah. Cable's a lot faster than DSL.
Yeah.
And for years, as we saw like 28 baud modems and they got faster and faster, there was kind of this theoretical maximum in DSL. And that's kind of been the assumed maximum that the phone line that's actually to a lot of people's homes could run. There's this new record-breaking event that happened, Actel-Lucent, which is in Europe, just got 10 gigabits of data transfer happening over a normal phone line for 100 meters. Now, that's not an extremely long distance, but the bandwidth is massive. It's like fiber
optics. Say that slower so I can really grok the numbers.
Yeah, 10 gigabits per second over 100 meters.
Wow.
Over a normal phone line.
And what's typical?
A DSL connection. Do you know what it is, Lindsay?
1.5 or something?
Yeah, 1.5 megabytes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So this is a lot.
I'm not sure about that.
Exponential. Sounds exponential.
1,000 times faster?
Yeah. That's faster.
Yeah. That's just 10,000 times faster. Yeah. Something like that. So the issue really has to do with electronics and what you can do. And this new technology is going at 106 megahertz transfer speed, and they're doing some really interesting stuff to make this happen. So it's not simple.
Yeah.
Additionally, the full 10 gigabit wouldn't be both directions. So the reason this is exciting is that right now, the reason why we don't have all fiber to our homes is fiber termination and split points are actually kind of pricey and difficult, and you have to run it all.
Right.
But if you look at most communities...
And when you say you have to run it all, you mean you have to actually physically get that stuff under street to houses.
Yes, hanging through the wire, through the air and everything.
Yeah.
And companies are doing this. But most of the time, the way to do it is to take a fiber line and go to a neighborhood. And then from the neighborhood, have a more traditional means to get to each house.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, it still would be expensive because that last little bit, you have to run a new kind of cable. You have to run, let's say Google wants to bring Google Fiber to your neighborhood. Well, they'll bring a fiber point close, but then they get from the fiber to your house, they still have to run a whole bunch of wires. That's one line and a day of work per house, which is very expensive. So it'd be much better if they could just use the lines that are already there, the copper.
Yeah.
That really isn't
so
being
important
used.
Experiments in using the infrastructure we already have.
Exactly.
Especially when phone companies are really kind of flirting with the idea of dropping landlines altogether.
Yeah. Now, so Bell Labs tested this prototype technology. It's called XG-Fast. XG.Fast.
Yeah.
And the thing that's really exciting about it is that probably by 2015, we'll actually see this productized. Which means that it could be that the U.S. transforms into a much faster network speeds and you'd have a competitor with your cable company for fast network. Really exciting stuff.
I like the competitor idea.
Yeah, you do. The competitor side is most important.
Here I am with my butt.
Please.
But when phone companies are wanting to ditch the whole landline infrastructure, it is in part because it's starting to need repair.
Right. So there's definitely a repair side of this.
Yeah.
I recently pulled an old phone line that was going to an old building that wasn't being used. I pulled it out of there and I ripped it apart. And the thing that was really interesting about it is the cable itself had hundreds of different phone lines.
Mm.
It used to be that the telcos would run, when they would say, hey, I need a line for my house, they would run a big bundle of wire because it was more expensive to actually have the man hour to put up the telephone pole and to run the wire than the actual wire itself. So they always overdo it.
Mm.
Two houses or two areas. So though it's failing, it still has a lot of potential if you could use it because there's a lot there. And that's kind of the trade-off.
Okay. Yeah, like I said, I'm not really aware of why it's failing, if it's just like wires need replacing or
switch boxes. I mean, basically, there's no reason to make sure the phone system works. There's less and less reason to make sure the landline phone system is up to date.
Mm-hmm.
It makes more sense for those big telcos to go ahead and run new fiber to new communities and put in other infrastructure, boost their cell phone towers, right? Because you can actually do better data transfer through a new cell phone tower than you can through a wire.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So these guys are researching how they can put those wires to better use.
Yeah.
By pushing data through super fast.
And basically means that it would be more viable to get fiber line speeds to your home. That's what this technology means.
And so how are they doing it? How are they pushing?
They're going higher frequency. They're doing a lot of complex math. That's basically the answer to that. That could be a whole dissertation about how this is being done because it's outside the bounds of what we used to. I mean, even DSL is pretty complicated. That actually works. Yeah. So getting into the technical stuff, I didn't read up enough of it to describe.
We aren't prepared to talk about that right now.
And I would be confusing myself by doing so.
Yeah. Okay. So just imagine whatever metaphor you want, and that's how it's happening. Excellent. Good reporting, you guys. let's see. Let's talk about other kinds of congestion.
Sure. I don't know if you... We've talked previously about the whole Netflix, people getting upset because they're not getting the bandwidth they want for streaming video services. Mm-hmm. And so many people use Netflix for their streaming video that they're the ones kind of catching the brunt of the consumer blowback.
Yeah, you remember how Netflix was the largest consumer or user of postal services?
Was it for a while?
It was. It was.
That's really funny.
It's way up there. And so now that's happening in the digital realm.
I think Netflix is a third of internet traffic right now in the U.S.
That's a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot.
Yeah. So 10 weeks ago, Netflix kind of caved and did something that they didn't originally want to do and agreed to pay Verizon for a direct connection to their network. So I don't know if you remember this thing going on with Comcast as well, where the users were upset. They wanted their movies at full bandwidth. Yeah. But there's something called a transit link that the providers like Netflix have to go across the transit link to get to the provider's network like Verizon or Comcast that are, you know, doing the groundwork. And if the speed through the transit link is not fast enough, then it doesn't matter how fast the rest of the network is. It's still going to bottleneck.
Okay.
There's companies like Cogent that are a transit link provider. So there's areas where... basically, there's finger pointing going on between like Cogent and Verizon, where Cogent is saying, "No, Verizon, you have to pay to upgrade our systems and our hardware if you want to use our network and be the major traffic on our networks."
Okay.
And Verizon's saying, "No, you're the transit provider. If people want more bandwidth, you have to upgrade your hardware." Some transit providers finally cave and, you know, pay to upgrade, or there's deals that go either way, and they don't disclose usually who pays what.
Right.
But Cogent is one of the last holdouts that's saying there's no way. We're not going to pay for it. Verizon has to pay for it.
Yeah.
So there's always going to be, even though Netflix has paid Verizon for a direct connect, which was previously done with Comcast, and I currently have Comcast at my house for a variety of reasons, and immediately my bandwidth went up when I was watching movies. Mm. You know, it almost tripled once this deal was made to pay for the direct connection. But the same thing has not been happening with people that are on the Verizon network for their cable. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason of that is that the deal between Netflix and Comcast, they built the infrastructure early on before the deal was, you know, the ink was even dry.
Okay.
So that when the ink was dry and the money was exchanged, the infrastructure was already there for the fast connection. Whereas the deal, Netflix has already agreed to pay Verizon, but the infrastructure's not there. And Verizon is doing a month-to-month rollout that's probably going to last through the end of the year that's kind of section by section. Mm-hmm. So if you are a Verizon customer, you may still be seeing a lot of slowdowns, even though the deal was already done quite a while ago. And especially if you're in an area where Cogent is, you know, doing the links, it's unlikely, unless they sort this finger pointing out, that you will ever see fast links. But I think what Cogent and other people are holding out for is hoping that the FCC will step in and say, here are some laws that govern who's responsible for this. Mm-hmm. They're hoping that it'll come in, you know, kind of in their favor, I think.
Okay.
That's my assumption.
Boys, get along here. Let me just lay down the law.
But yeah, so if you're Verizon and Netflix, just be patient. It may roll out to you soon or by the end of the year.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's going to be certain areas that may still have problems depending on who handles the transit links.
So for full disclosure, I actually work for Netflix, and I actually know some internal information about the company, as all Netflix employees do. So I can't talk a lot about the details about this, but I would like to show you that Netflix has a service called the ISP Speed Index. And so here's a graph of Comcast versus a Verizon's network traffic from January to now.
Mm-hmm. And which one's which?
The one that has a giant that increases really high and goes really fast after February, that's Comcast.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So
the other one's
paid, not paid.
Well,
didn't pay ransom.
Yeah, it's just an interesting way to look at it. Also, this system has a lot of services for different ISPs in your area. And you can see what ISPs have certain speeds as Netflix rates them, you know, sees that traffic. So it's kind of a cool system to see what kind of speeds you can get, assuming that what you care about is Netflix, of course.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And there was a recent release by Verizon trying to explain this to some customers, but the graphic that they posted kind of makes it look like it's Netflix's choice of carrier that's causing the issue. And so there's a little like finger pointing going on. And then Netflix, when there's issues, they sometimes pop something up saying, you know, the Verizon connection is busy. So yeah, there's just okay. a little...
They're being a little snarky.
Yeah.
A little snarky snark.
People are angry that Verizon wants money from everybody, I guess.
Interesting. I've had a general idea of how like networks actually work at this level for years, because we talk on GeekSpeak about how the internet works. But then when you get into the nitty gritty of like the data flow, it gets more complicated.
Yeah.
You know, it's the point where it's like, oh, okay, how do you explain this to the general population? And at this point...
Right.
I don't think a lot of clarity is emerging for everybody on what's happening.
Right. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, if you're the geeky type and you want to get into the nitty-gritty, I'll post the article and there are links to other articles that get into the details of the networking components that are in place.
Cool.
Yeah, more networking stuff.
A while ago, we talked about a hilariously and seemingly just bauble of a... what is this? Is it an app? It's an app.
Yo
app. And all it did, like, you could use it and you'd send yo to somebody and then they could send you yo back. That's all it was. And we had a good laugh about what a ridiculous little fun bauble it is. And apparently it's found a way to become useful.
Indeed. So basically the app was infamous for its, you know, lack of utility, but now it's being used to warn Israeli citizens about rocket strikes. What's going on is that there is an app called Red Alert Israel, and it's been alerting Israelis about incoming attacks by Gaza terrorists during the Hamas-Israel conflict. And Yo can integrate with that app, and so instead of just getting the alarm, you get a Yo, and it gives you a location. And so you can tell if the location is nearby you, like incoming, you know?
Yeah.
And so you can take action based on the locations. But it's, you know, they're talking about starting to use this for other kinds of notification integrations. So, like, you know, you have a favorite website and you want to get notifications when there are updates. You know, you might be able to use it as a plugin and then get a notification or a yo every time there's an update to something.
It's interesting because it's like the infrastructure of what they have, the ability to push notifications to people quickly, has become a service that other people start using, right?
Right.
It's a very cool side effect of having a successful app that just doesn't do anything much, right?
Right.
All of a sudden you get people going, well, I'd love to be able to send notifications to that thing.
Exactly. And the origins of it, I've been hearing different stories. One was that it was an April Fool's joke, and the other one is that it was somebody wanting a way to notify their assistant, of, you know, like, hey, I need you. And so it was just like,
instead
write this little app.
Across the office.
Right.
It's not Mad Men.
All right.
So basically using the same infrastructure, but it doesn't actually say yo.
Right. It's it doesn't actually say yo. I'm assuming that it actually just gives you whatever alarm your phone has and puts a yo in your message.
Right, right.
But I've heard different stories about that, and I don't have it installed either.
I think it's time to install yo.
Yeah, you think so.
Yeah, interesting. All right. I was just going to laugh at it, but now apparently it's useful. Well, in the minute that we have left, just like a quick thing, we ongoingly on this show, we talk about coding and how everyone should code, and I'm sort of like a staunch holdout because I'm not refusing to do so. But there have been all these efforts to get kids interested in it, like code.org has done those great weekends where everyone comes and they do a bunch of coding and they achieve something, they make something happen, and then they have like, hey, look what I did. And then a lot of those kids go home where they don't have a computer and do not continue to code.
Yeah, that's a serious problem.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, just offering classes online is a good way to teach kids to code who are already relatively well off and already kind of wired in. So there's been another effort by Connected Learning Alliance working with Pursuitary, which targets kids who don't have that kind of access to technology. And what they have found is that by partnering with libraries, where there's a bank of computers where anyone can use that are open to the public and real live people to interact with, apparently they have like events at the library. Now, that's a good way to actually keep learners motivated beyond their initial lessons when they don't have that kind of technology at home that they can fiddle around with. A woman named Mimi Ito wrote an article about this on Boing Boing, and we'll have a link to that up at the website also. It's kind of an interesting initiative.
It's interesting because it seems like it would be a really good service to people that are not in grade school anymore, right? Because in the grades, I'd love the education of computer programming to happen at grade school level so that anybody in a public school could be doing that. But when you're out of that environment, right now, there's a large population that doesn't know anything about computers, really. that's the space to do it, right? Public libraries.
Right.
Or community colleges, I think, is another great
And
space.
If we're talking about rising the boats, you know, if you want everyone to program, then it's good to be teaching people who would not already probably be getting around to it at some point anyway.
Very fair.
Yeah, very fair. But you still haven't gotten me. Oh, my goodness.
Our goal, get Bonnie.
Yeah, really.
Get Bonnie to program. Well, so, Bonnie, why is it not interesting to you?
Honey, I can't even get myself to do printmaking, which I love regularly.
It's about all the things you possibly could do that are joyous and wonderful that you're not doing because you're busy.
It has more to do with kind of like my internal relationship to effort.
I feel you, sister.
I'm pretty sure that's it. I'm happy to come here and talk every week with you guys, though, about things that happen.
This is enough.
Yeah, this is enough.
Enough
geekery. That's my proximity to being useful.
We've exhausted
Well, everything we talk about on GeekSpeak, we actually put up with more commentary and stuff on geekspeak.org. So anytime you'd like to participate more in the conversation, geekspeak.org is a great place to get the start. We're also on a whole bunch of public venues like Facebook and Google Plus and Twitter, and you can communicate with us that way as well. And we'd love to hear that kind of communication and such. So please feel free to continue the conversation online.
Please do. Geeks at geekspeak.org. And today we've benefited from Miles uploading the things we were talking about as we were talking about them on the website. So you can go there right now and read up on everything that we've talked about today.
Thanks, Miles.
Yeah. Well, listen, guys, GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, so use our stuff any way you like, but tell them the geeks say hi. This is Public Radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz, live online at KUSP.org. And as Lyle said, to find out more about this or any episode of GeekSpeak, please visit GeekSpeak.org. This has been the show for June 21st, 2014, and thank you for listening. To Lindsay Lonnie, Lyle Troxell, Miles Elam in the background, and myself, Bonnie French.